You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Yemen's crisis takes an unexpected twist. A returning secessionist leader is arrested at the airport. We head to Sana'a for the latest. Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks, could be granted asylum in Ecuador. We work out what on earth he's going to do in Quito. The Flatpak Hotel is coming to a town near you. Well, sort of. IKEA is moving into hospitality.
This is not really for backpackers or students, as much as for some mobile businessmen who don't want to stay and spend as much as they would do in established business hotels, but equally they don't want to be seen to be staying in travel lodges.
That was Hugo McDonald. We'll also be skateboarding in the GDR, finding out about the latest Swiss banking scandal, and Rob will be here to tell us all about the culture section in the new issue of the magazine. Rob?
Indeed, we'll delve into the defence issue by looking into the kit bags of war reporters, from cameras and notebooks to Lucky Charms.
Thank you very much. All that to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news from around the world.
An airstrike by a Syrian jet in the northern town of Azaz has killed as many as 80 people today and wounded 150. Residents in the town screamed and shouted, "God is greatest," as they carry bloodied bodies from collapsed concrete buildings. An activist from the opposition Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said at least 30 bodies had been found and rescuers were searching for more. The trial of the man accused of firing the gun that killed honeymooner Annie Dewani has begun today in Cape Town, South Africa. Zolile Mngeni was declared fit to stand trial despite suffering a malignant brain tumour. The public prosecutor heard evidence from the prosecution witness on the first day of the trial.
The witness told the court today that he was informed by Zola Tongo that the man from abroad, Shirin Dewani, it was not his first time in South Africa. He has been in the country before, where he was involved in a murder of a person in South Africa, and that murder was made to look like a hijacking.
China has today demanded that Japan immediately and unconditionally free 14 Chinese activists held over a protest landing on disputed islands as tensions between Tokyo and its neighbours flared on the anniversary of the end of World War II. The landing by the activists on an island chain in the East China Sea and their detention by Japan's Coast Guard came on a day of regional diplomatic jousting, as earlier South Korea prompted an official protest from Japan after the South Korean President Lee Myung-bak made insults about the Japanese Emperor Akihito. Israelis are increasingly concerned of an unprecedented missile war if their military was to carry out a long-threatened strike on Iranian nuclear sites. Yet Professor Etienne Gilboa, an expert on Israel-US relations, says while US politicians prepare for presidential elections in November, they will not allow Israel to drag America into a regional war in the Middle East.
There is a considerable mistrust between Washington and Jerusalem. First, the United States is not certain whether or not Israel will strike Iran before the presidential elections. And Israel is not sure whether the United States will use force and lives up to its commitment to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons even after the November elections.
The Duke of Edinburgh, the husband of the Queen, has been taken to hospital in Scotland today as a precautionary measure, Buckingham Palace has said. 2 months ago, Prince Philip was taken to hospital with a bladder infection, overshadowing 4 days of celebrations for the Queen's 60th year on the British throne. In December last year, the 91-year-old had an operation to clear a blocked heart artery and spent Christmas in hospital. And finally, hundreds of Ugandans have jammed Entebbe Airport to welcome home Stephen Kiprotich after he won his country's first Olympic gold medal for 40 years. He won the London Games men's marathon last Sunday. He urged President Museveni to set up proper training facilities to help young and aspiring athletes discover their talents. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It is 21.05, just turned in Dubai, 18.05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24 です.
Lontosta käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
London boy, as a Monocle 24.
Londadan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, sinä Monocle 24.
London から, London より, Monocle 24.
We begin in Yemen. When the Arab uprising swept across North Africa and the Gulf early last year, some of the most passionate protests were in Yemen. President Ali Abdullah Saleh had ruled the country since North and South united in 1990. He was no Democrat, though, and as his grip on power began to crumble, Yemen's disparate parts started to splinter. There is, it's fair to say, now little central control. Some parts of the country are run by various tribal groups, while a secessionist movement in the south, centred around the old British colony of Aden, has gained momentum. Earlier today, a secessionist leader from the south, who had been based abroad, tried to return to Aden. He was promptly arrested on arrival. Iona Craig is a British journalist based in Yemen, and she joins me now from the capital, Sana'a. Iona, welcome to Midori House. Now, I understand that Ahmed Abdullah al-Hassani, the secessionist leader in question, has now been released. Talk us through what's actually happened so far today.
Yes, it appears that gunmen ran onto the plane and actually snatched him away without any resistance from the security forces who were present at the airport. So it was unclear who he'd actually been arrested by. And in fact, the reports now that he's been released, the security forces in Aden are saying that it was a mistake and they had nothing to do with these gunmen that apparently boarded the plane and removed him. But as you say, yes, he's a secessionist leader and the movement has been growing in momentum over the past year. And there have been other secessionist members, leaders like him, who have returned to Aden without any problems. So it was quite a surprise when this happened today.
And how popular has the movement become in the south? Because, I mean, obviously North and South Yemen, there's not as many similarities as there are in other countries. They've always felt quite separate in the south. Is there, I mean, obviously there's a growing political movement, but does it have much popular support?
It does, but it's a very divided movement. It's known here as Hirak, or the Southern Movement. But they're deeply divided within themselves about what they really want. Some of them want succession, they want division once again and to go back to the situation of pre-1990 to a socialist state. Others just want more independence from the north but not necessarily to break away from northern rule. And then there's others that talk of federalism. And this is the big problem with the southern movement. At the moment we're in the process, which will be starting once Ramadan ends, of getting into the process of national dialogue here, which has come out of last year's uprising and the deal that was negotiated after that. And the southern movement have not really committed themselves, their leaders have not committed themselves to that process as yet. So it's very much something of a thorn in the side for this national dialogue process. And really they're not one coherent bloc. They don't speak with one voice, which makes it even more complicated, really.
And on the whole, how much of it is a political movement and how much of it is an armed movement?
Well, actually, it's a political movement. The armed part of it was really disbanded and crushed, really, after the Civil War. There hasn't really been an army associated to the Southern Movement or a really cohesive military wing at all since 1994, since the Civil War. So at the moment, yes, it's a political movement, but without a definite single focus and a single goal at the end of it.
And looking more broadly at Yemen as a whole, if we can talk about Yemen even being a whole at the moment, it's now 6 months since Ali Abdullah Saleh was ousted. His successor, who was the vice president, Abed Hadi, is in power. Well, he's in office, but perhaps not necessarily in power. And there's been certain clashes, haven't there, this week?
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem. Although Saleh himself left, his family members still remain in command of a lot of the major military units. The army itself divided last year during the uprising and hasn't been reunited. So the biggest problem that Hadi has been facing is trying to reconcile the army without upsetting the balance entirely, which could then lead to a situation of possible war again. So you have Saleh's family members and indeed commanders who still support Saleh on one side, and then you have the renegade leader of Ali Mohsen al-Akhmar, who is sort of in the middle of all this. So yes, Hadi has been trying to reorganize the army, and that's really the underlying problem that's kind of related to these clashes that we had yesterday here in Sana'a. There were two people killed outside the Ministry of Defense, a unit of the Republican Guard, which is under the control of Ahmed Saleh, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president, his son. One of those units under his command in the recent restructuring program was supposed to be moved away from his command. Those soldiers that are due to be reorganized took objection to this. They claimed it was largely down to money because they claimed they hadn't been paid, and also the Republican Guard get paid more than regular soldiers, which they're about to become. So yes, we had heavy clashes here in Sana'a yesterday, and for similar reasons we had clashes about 2 weeks ago at the Ministry of Interior as well, which left 15 people dead.
Now, Iona, you've been covering this uprising, if we can still call it an uprising, for the last couple of years as one of the few Western journalists based out in Sana'a. I mean, this started as a would-be revolution, didn't it? Fairly peaceful, lots of protests, tens of thousands of people on the streets. It seems to have, within a few months of that, descended into something of a civil war. Are the original revolutionaries still protesting? Is there still much of a peaceful political movement pushing for change in Yemen?
There is, actually. I mean, we got close to civil war last year, of course, but we didn't actually reach that point, although it kind of felt like it here at some point. But yeah, the protesters, they are. I mean, actually, if you walk into Western Sana'a now, they are still camped out on the streets. They're still living in their tents outside the university in the west of Sana'a, and there are similar camps still existing in the city of Taiz and in Al Baida and across the country. The numbers in some cases have reduced, but here the one in Sana'a is particularly large. And yes, the activists are still wanting to push forward this process. Everybody now is trying to focus on the national dialogue. We've already discussed there are these underlying problems with the military, but people are still hopeful. They're probably not filled with as much hope that they're going to get the change that they were really pushing for last year as they perhaps were in February, when there was a lot of optimism when Hadi, even though it was only a one-man election, was voted in. People really saw it as a moment of change. But it's really how much change are they going to get? We've got a lot of the old regime still in place, and it's a very long and slow process at the moment.
And finally, just looking ahead, and we've talked about all the different problems there are in Yemen, with parts of the country not feeling as if they actually should belong to the whole. In 5-10 years' time, will there still be one Yemen, or is the country likely to split up?
That's the question that everybody asks. It's difficult to say. If the southern secessionists become involved in the national dialogue and we go through that process, there may be something in between both of those scenarios. There may be a federal system or something similar to a federal system here in Yemen, which means that, you know, various areas have more autonomy, because that would probably satisfy both the southern movement and, of course, the northern Houthis, who also want autonomy in their own region up in the north. So perhaps that's the compromise. The single one strong state, it's never really existed in Yemen, this kind of central government control. As you mentioned, you know, tribal areas have kind of run their own show in their own areas. And to be able to concentrate that through Sana'a is a challenge now, and it will, you know, generally tend to be so in the coming years. So perhaps, you know, the idea of federalism, which is often talked about now and increasingly so as we come up to this period of national dialogue, is the compromise. But whether people will go for that, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Iona Craig in Sana'a, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, Visit modern-thailand.com.
The perfect accompaniment to summer is a well-mixed cocktail, so as the season hits its stride, we handpicked a trio of bartenders from around the world to prepare for us their cocktail du jour. From Tokyo to São Paulo via Beirut, we filmed the maestros at work, headlining the Yoshida Martini, the Lychee Caipirinha, and the Aromatic Smash. Pull up a bar stool for a front row seat. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House, 1815 in London, 1215 in Quito. For the last 8 weeks, the Embassy of Ecuador in London has had an unwelcome house guest. The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, turned up on their doorstep claiming asylum. He claimed that if he was sent to Sweden to face trial for rape, he ran the risk of eventually being extradited to the US for publishing hundreds of thousands of classified documents. After much diplomatic to-ing and fro-ing, it appears that the Ecuadorian government may be willing to grant Assange his request. But what can he actually expect from life in Quito? Joining us now to give us a rundown on the Quito experience is Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck.
And this is from a man who's never been there. But I am going to give you an insight into the Quito experience.
But you've been looking into it all day.
Yes, I have been looking into it all day.
All over. Let's start with his arrival there. If he actually manages to get on a plane, which I'm still dubious about. If he gets on a plane...
Yeah, because let's be honest, there's a difference between being offered asylum and actually the British allowing you out of the country. So that's one.
Let's assume that happens, though. He gets on a plane.
The government say, yes, go away, please, and get on the plane. Well, the first thing is that he should worry a little bit because it's one of the most dangerous airports in the world because it's in a kind of a narrow valley. The actual airport is almost downtown, so it's surrounded by buildings. Plus, there are very, very high mountains. So in the last few years, there have been six major crashes at the airport and quite a loss of life and lots of near incidents. It's not the kind of airport that you would want to kind of do your daily commute from.
Right. OK. But let's assume he gets there safely. What can he expect when he arrives there? I mean, what sort of food is he going to be eating?
Well, if he wants to go traditional, he could have a guinea pig snack.
Nice. I like a good guinea pig snack every now and then.
They're not that fattening. That's the good thing about them. You can have a second one if the first one...
I must say, whenever I eat guinea pig, I always think, oh, I wish I could have a second.
Now, we did speak to actually a friend of the Monocle who is Ecuadorian today. And when we asked her about what her lasting impression of being from Quito was, and she said, we drink a lot. So there's a lot of alcohol. And she did warn that there are special buses that go around Quito that don't have any doors on them. So that seems another kind of another way that he could come to a kind of a deadly end rather quickly.
Particularly if he has a few drinks, then gets on a bus with no doors.
Yes, although oddly the most popular beer is Pilsner. So its beer is the most popular. The Pilsner beer is the most popular drink, actually, in the city.
Okay.
But he can go local. There are more local brews. So if he's kind of feeling a bit miserable, he can go out for a guinea pig and a Pilsner, and that should drown his sorrows a little bit.
Okay, if he wanted to be entertained, I understand there's a song we could play, which gives us an idea of what sort of music they listen to in Ecuador.
Well,
do you want to introduce it?
Well, let's introduce it. This was Santiago, who works with us upstairs, who's from Colombia. He was a little bit sniffy about the quality of the popular music coming out of Quito. But he did tell me about this man called Delfin Quispe, who shot to fame in Latin America with a song about 9/11. And it is worth looking up Delfin Quispe on YouTube just to see this song, because it's him kind of virtually shaking his maracas in front of the tumbling towers. There's something completely wrong about it.
Right.
And then his second hit is this hit, which I'm not sure Julian's going to enjoy very much. It's called Israel, Israel. And again, try and see the YouTube video. He manages to fit in everything from kind of llamas to kind of workers standing around watching him jiggle around. This is his tribute to why Israel is the best country in the world. And oddly, it's the biggest hit to come out of Quito.
¡Tigresa del Oriente!
That was Delphine Kishib with Israel, Israel.
It's such a surprising song to come out of Quito, but that's the kind of thing that he'll be getting on down at the local nightclubs. I did actually look at the cultural diary, or got the help of, again, Santiago to check up. There was one thing listed for tonight.
Really?
So I don't think he's going to have a very busy cultural time.
Okay.
Let's not be mean about Ecuador. I'm sure there's lots of things that you can do.
No, indeed.
Eat a guinea pig.
Now, Julian Assange, he's quite big on the web, isn't he? He's going to probably want to be, you know, on the internet every now and then, if only to keep up with what friends he has left. How easy is that in Ecuador?
Well, only 30% of Ecuadorians are actually on the internet at all. So that's not very good. So it's not, if he wants to kind of spread leaks around the country, he's not going to do very well. But I did look up to find him a nice internet cafe he can go to. There's the Papaya Net Internet Cafe, and that seems to welcome people all day. It does add at the bottom of this review, it says the hardware does need some maintenance. But apart from that, I think he might be technical. He could
do that. He could help out.
Yes, I'm sure he could kind of roll up his sleeves.
He probably actually needs a job. What is he going to do for money? He could work in that internet cafe.
Well, let's just add the other kind of annoying thing from about the currency there is that Ecuador is a dollarized economy, so it uses the US dollar. So he's scared of ending up in the US, but he's going to be rather dependent on America for all his spending power while he's in Ecuador, if he gets there.
Andrew Tuck. Thank you very much indeed. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're talking about Swiss banking after this.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London is New York, is Hong Kong, is Tokyo. Sino Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monaco 24.
Londonbo, as a Monaco 24.
Londodan, burası Monaco 24.
Londonist, sinä Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é Monaco 24.
O que que ninä teiru no wa Monaco 24.
Afto ennen to Monaco 24.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
Du lyssnar på Monaco 24.
Kuuntelet Monaco 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 hardback, yeah.
UBS should be getting used to this by now. The Swiss bank found itself on the wrong side of the US tax man in 2009, leading to a fine of $780 million. Now it's found itself in a fight with the government of North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's largest state. UBS is accused of helping clients move their money from Switzerland to Asian low-tax destinations like Singapore. The reason? From next year, Germans with Swiss bank accounts will have to pay large fees to maintain the cloak of anonymity that Swiss banks have traditionally offered. If it's true, and UBS deny it, German and Swiss regulators, both determined to clean up a sometimes murky banking sector, would not be happy. Joining me on the line from Zurich is Marianne Fassbind, economics editor of Swiss TV station SF. Marianne, welcome to Midori House. Just how serious are these allegations against UBS?
Well, that's very difficult to say, but yesterday they denied that they had more clients from Germany and Singapore until 2009, that the inflow of German money was not... it was the opposite, that money outflows from German clients from Singapore. So it's difficult to say, but I think it was difficult for UBS that they could, after 2008-2009, transmit German clients to Singapore.
And just how determined are Swiss regulators generally to try and clean up the banking sector? Because obviously they've had, you know, enormous problems over the past few years since the big crash in 2008. Do you get a sense that they're really determined to make these changes?
Sorry, can you repeat, please?
Do you get a sense that the Swiss regulators, banking regulators, are determined to actually make real changes to the way that the banking system works?
Yes, of course. I mean, they want to do a white money strategy that was clearly set last year, 2 years before also. And I think they're really serious on that. And we have also already banks which are doing this strictly, like the Bank Sarasin, I don't know if you heard about, which was taken over from a Brazilian bank group suffer. So I'm sure that the government is very straight on this.
And in terms of these specific allegations against UBS, obviously the German tax authorities in North Rhine-Westphalia are going to start investigating. Talk us through what happens next.
Well, I don't know, but I think it's really a political matter. I mean, Rhineland-Westphalia has problem to get into in the election, the next election, and of course it gives media advertisement for this big largest country of Germany, and also we heard in the last days that there were German which are now really saying that they have money which is not have been taxed, and of course that is good for Germany if a lot of Germans now want, before this tax agreement, want to change their position.
Marianne Fassbind in Zurich, thank you very much indeed. We're going to play a song now. This is Nantes by Beirut.
It's been a long time now.
That was Nantes by Beirut. And in the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be delving into war reporters' kit bags and talking to the director of a new film about skateboarding. Oh, yes. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. An airstrike by a Syrian jet in the northern town of Azaz has killed as many as 80 people today and wounded 150. An activist from the opposition Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said at least 30 bodies have been found so far, and rescuers were searching for more. The trial of the man accused of firing the gun that killed honeymooner Annie Dewani has begun today in Cape Town, South Africa. Zulile Mngeni was declared fit to stand trial despite suffering a malignant brain tumour. China has today demanded that Japan immediately and unconditionally free 14 Chinese activists held over a protest landing on disputed islands as tensions between Tokyo and its neighbours flared on the anniversary of the end of the Second World War. The Duke of Edinburgh, the husband of the Queen, has been taken to hospital in Scotland today as a precautionary measure, Buckingham Palace has said. 2 months ago, Prince Philip was taken to hospital with a bladder infection, overshadowing 4 days of celebrations for the Queen's 60th year on the British throne. And finally, hundreds of Ugandans have jammed Entebbe Airport to welcome home Stephen Kiprotich after he won his country's first Olympic gold medal for 40 years. He won the London Games men's marathon last Sunday. And those are the stories for the moment on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's 18:31 here in London. The new issue of Monocle is on newsstands tomorrow. Subscribers, of course, have it on their coffee tables already. It's defence-themed, and in the culture section, that means everything from going through the kit bags of war reporters to meeting the Israeli radio station run by the army. Robert Bound, our culture editor, joins me now to have a look inside. Hello, Rob.
Hi. I haven't got a coffee table. I've got a tea trolley.
Have you?
I like that.
Is it on your tea trolley at home?
No, it's not. Oh. Okay. It's by the bed.
Okay, fair enough.
What
good.
Better place to delve into war reporters' kit bags, right?
than while lying in bed.
Exactly.
Well, let's actually leave the war reporters' kit bags in a moment, because we're actually going to talk to one of them in a bit.
Okay.
Through the magic of telephones. Let's look at the rest of the C section.
Yeah, cool. It was a fun one to put together this month. It's quite weird. We were saying, weren't we, before we did the show, that sometimes a theme helps you kind of corral your thoughts.
Yes.
And you kind of think,
it's not just four great stories, it's let's think about this and see how it works together.
It allows you to think quite laterally. In the culture section, I was like, how on earth am I going to kind of put together a defence theme? But it kind of worked really rather well, because you go all media, and there is a surprising amount of quite cool publishers And radio stations and bits and bobs that, you know, either get their money from the military or on, there's Gal Galatz, which maybe we can talk about first.
Yeah, go on.
Which is the Israeli radio station, which is in Tel Aviv, which is on like I guess many small countries, which is on a military frequency, and especially such militarized countries as Israel is on a military frequency, and yet it's the KCRW or the Radio 1 or the Nova FM of Israel.
And they're all there, sort of in their uniforms.
Imagine if you were there now, Steve. We'd be in fatigues.
Yeah, I'm not wearing fatigues today. I decided not to.
I know you normally like to run things with military precision, Steve. But you could have left off the epaulets for once. So Gal Galatz Radio, it's cool. It's worth tuning into. As well, there is a box off the back of this story, which has got a sort of selection of other
and all the frequencies,
so you can tune in. A lot, most of them are online, like we are.
Yes, Fort Hood Radio from Fort Hood, Texas.
That's in Texas.
Yeah, you can tune in at forthoodradio.com.
And what's weird is that because especially as the sort of clear channelification, should we say, of US radio, where everything kind of sounds the same. Weirdly, these radio stations sound great. You know, they're kind of what we're trying to do, but they're, you know, obviously a bit odder. But they are. They sort of play really quite good records, and they have quite sort of oddball kind of feature ideas, and kind of DJs with genuinely quite individual voices, because they're not. There's no kind of demographic. It's literally like blokes in army uniform that play records.
And how many of them are actually aimed just at military people, and how many are actually just for everyone?
Well, pretty much all, as I said, 99% of them are aimed at military personnel, you know, within a certain radius, if it's an FM thing, or on certain bases or on certain ships, aircraft carriers, etc. But there are few and far between the ones like Gal Galatz that actually are like a public service broadcaster that happen to be owned by the military and staffed by kind of people doing their commission. What do you call it? It's not a commission. What do you call it? National service.
Yes, they're national service.
And I mean, we talked before in South Korea. South Korean kind of rock music in the 60s and 70s sounded really American and a bit British and sort of psychedelic and cool, because the only radio station that all the Koreans listened to, or people in Seoul certainly listened to, was the American Forces Network, which was broadcast from a base in the middle of Seoul, where the Americans still have a base, and that was the most powerful frequency that you could get in Seoul. So it's kind of an interesting thing, and it has kind of an interesting back story.
We also did some stuff about military magazines as well.
Yeah.
We particularly focus on Y in Germany.
I don't know what German for Y is. It's rather embarrassing.
Just say Y.
Let's call it Y magazine. So this is staffed half by military personnel and half made. It's half in the Bundeswehr barracks in Berlin, and half it's at this kind of quite cool creative agency in Berlin. So half the people are kind of in kind of Converse, and half of them are in khaki again. So it's a kind of interesting thing, especially interesting because obviously Germany has doesn't necessarily have a defence force like Japan has, but it has obviously a kind of like checkered history with its military and a strange relationship with its military. This magazine, to give our listeners a feel for it, Steve, is kind of like, there's a cool cover there. It's sort of like, I don't know, it's a bit like a better version of FHM or something, but specifically for the military,
and not half-clad women on the front. In fact, it's a man in a balaclava who actually looks rather scary.
In Germany, that is a sexy woman. We'll just leave that hanging.
Yeah, let's leave that. we'll turn to the war reporter's kit bags, which is actually one of my favourite parts in Time magazine.
That was my favourite bit to put together. It's really cool.
We'll turn to that in a minute, because we're going to also talk to Seb Meyer, one of the war photographers who is in it. But first, before that, I wanted to play a song. I wanted to play one of the tracks by James Yorkston, who came in earlier this week for a Midori House session for your culture show, didn't he, Rob?
Yeah, so James came in. He did four tracks from his new album called I Was a Cat from a Book. And I chatted to him, and these songs are going to be played in their entirety on next Monday's Culture Show, which is a music special. What song are we going to hear? I don't know.
I thought you knew.
I actually don't know. It's Catch.
Let's play Catch.
It's Catch.
For every hour on the road elsewhere, we talked about a future so special. I had no doubts you could become a confidence I'd not seen of you. So rare, a turning of the head.
That was James Yorkston with a little bit of clapping in the background.
That was nice. That song was called, the song that we thought had no name was in fact called Catch.
Yes.
Fiddle and can clap there evoking a sort of autumnal scene up in Fife where he lives and records his songs. That was rather beautiful.
It was indeed. The whole session was beautiful, although I particularly liked the moment where the violinist, who was also trying to sing at the same time, had a little hiccup. Halfway through.
Harmony.
Yes, but yeah. it was beautiful. You're listening to Midori House. It's 1841 here in London. It's with me, Steve Bloomfield. Robert Bound is still here. We're talking about the new issue of Monocle, which hits newsstands tomorrow. And specifically now, we're going to talk about the kits belonging to various people, artists, reporters, photographers who go after wars. And in particular, we're going to talk about the kit belonging to Sebastian Meyer, which has been beautifully photographed.
By himself,
yes, exactly. And Sebastian joins us now from Iraq. Hello, Sebastian.
Hello.
Excellent. Slight delay there, but don't worry, it's going to be fine. Sebastian, talk us through your kit bag, the things you decide to take. Talk us through what you've got there.
Mainly all the stuff in the bag is very utilitarian. The boring stuff, like, cameras and chargers and extra batteries and things like that. But there are a few things that I take as well that are important. And I found that one of the most important things that I've taken is medicine for hay fever, because it can be absolutely debilitating if you get allergies out in the field. So I always make sure that I have my Claritin or whatever I can pick up on the way.
Sebastian, I'm sorry, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop you there because the line isn't fantastic. But thank you very much for trying nonetheless. Rob is still here, and Rob, you can talk us through it in a bit more detail.
Yeah,
some of the things. As you mentioned there, he's got Claritin for hay fever and various medicines, but also an awful lot of kit. 3 mobile phones I see there.
Yeah, these kit bags were all interesting. I'll just talk us through all of them, actually.
We had
Sebastian Meyer, who unfortunately was crackly, understandably, from Iraq there. Matthew Cook, who's the war artist, first commissioned by the London Times, who a lot of readers probably recognise his work. He's also appeared in Monocle. Alex Crawford from Sky News, who is the famous reporter who sort of was the first person to go into Tripoli when Gaddafi fell.
And she even has, the one bit of kit that I'm quite excited about there is the BGAN, which is the satellite transmitting equipment which she which they used on the back of that truck as they were going into Tripoli with the rebels to stream back that live, astonishing sort of 45
minutes.
Yes,
this is the machine on which it was done, and they had to smuggle. They recorded stuff. She says a little bit in the words here, but it was interesting speaking to her. I interviewed her on the phone from her home in Johannesburg before she went out to Syria. I think now she's there for Sky. And she said, that she had to smuggle out the memory stick or the memory cards from the cameraman's cameras through sort of 7 checkpoints, and she had to hide them in her bra. They had to hide them in loaves of bread in their sock. They were sort of almost practically strip searched for this stuff. And that was the way that they got out this footage that ended up being that famous footage. Also, interesting for Alex Crawford, she's got a burqa there.
Yeah.
Which was really interesting. She bought that in a market in Kabul. And then she bought one that was sort of really new, and it looked a bit conspicuous. And obviously, she kind of doesn't walk.
Yes.
She doesn't walk like an Afghani woman. She doesn't walk like a Muslim woman behind her. She's had to learn to walk behind her camera crew and stuff. So she bought one that was a bit fancy, and she ended up swapping it with a wife of one of their translators, who was so pleased to get this sort of brand new burqa, and swapped it for an older one. So the one you see there is the one that was swapped, which is quite interesting. There's a story behind sort of every single bit of this stuff.
There really is. John Lee Anderson. We're very remiss not to mention staff writer in New York, who's an incredible reporter. 2 things stand out to me about his kit bag. One, I'm very envious of this, no laptop. He's just got his notebooks and pens.
He's got really old school Nokia phone as well.
He doesn't have to file when he's there. He can take months over if he wants. And also, yes, the phones was the other thing I want to mention. He's got his iPhone, yes, but he's also got a Thuraya satellite phone. And he's also got a very old school Nokia phone, a double SIM Nokia. which allows him to have two SIM cards at the same time.
That's damn good.
It is. I used to have one of those. It was great.
So his is quite sort of military looking. And then Matthew Cooks, who's the war artist, you know, he's got sort of like his flak jacket and bombproof helmet mixed up with his watercolours and his paintbrushes, which is sort of like rather beautifully tells the story, I guess, of what a war reporter is.
It really is. Take a look at all four of those. They're wonderful. Rob Bound, thank you very much.
Cheers, Steve.
Seb Meyer in Iraq, thank you briefly for you too. You're listening to Midori House. We're skateboarding next.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the latest edition of The Menu, Monocle 24's weekly food and drink show, we discover what a restaurateur is faced with when he wants to organise a pop-down event, that is, serving food 80 metres underground. We also get great lessons for baking amazing tarts, meet an American chef who has managed to break into the Italian food scene, and we head to the West Bank to find out what a 100-mile diet Palestinian style is.
Our concept was to create a new style of restaurant, serve just fresh food and natural food.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're back with Midori House. It's 18:48 here in London, 10:48 a.m. in San Francisco. I promise you skateboarding. Don't worry, it is coming, but not just yet. One of the fastest growing sectors in the hotel business is what is known as budget design hotels. The boom in this area has followed the industry's somewhat belated discovery that there might be a happy medium between the overpriced palace with solid gold plumbing and a butler and the backpacker fire trap regarded with horrified pity by inmates of the local prison. The latest company to take an interest in providing pleasant but affordable hotel accommodation is IKEA. The Swedish company has ambitions of building at least 100 budget hotels across Europe, hoping to emulate the success of such chains as Munich-based Hotel One. And it marks a stepping up of an interest in property presently best demonstrated by IKEA's plans to build a 1,200-home development at London's Olympic Park. A little earlier on the briefing, Andrew Muller spoke to Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, and our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. He started by asking, how important is the association of the IKEA brand to the hotel?
There's going to be an enormous amount of PR buzz. This story came out actually in the Frankfurter Allgemeine yesterday. It's starting to be picked up, and there's no official name yet. And I think what's interesting as well is it's going to be operated by a third party. So I think the third party is the operator. They're going to have certainly a massive PR initiative around this. And IKEA, while when it comes to disclosing their finances, and the movements of Mr. Kamprad, their founder, etc., that's a rather tangled web, and they're very PR shy. When it comes to, PRing Billy shelves and new colors, they're very good at that.
How much room for growth do you think there is in this budget design market?
Well, I think the timing couldn't be better, because we only have to look at even the very slow growth that we're seeing in Germany at the moment. So that means corporates are going to be an enormous part of this when it comes to filling rooms in and around business parks and airports all over Europe. And of course, Germany is going to be the first market where they open up. So no matter what scale of business you're looking at right now, certainly for, various members of a company, they're going to have to be staying within a certain price band. And if we're looking at what the next three to five years, if not longer, are going to be quite tough in Europe, and you're going to have CFOs who are really watching what room nights are costing, the timing really couldn't be better for them.
And Hugo, to come to you now, the hotels of this class are called budget design hotels. Of those two components, which is the more important, the budget part or the design part?
I think, as Tyler's pointed out, this is not really for backpackers or students as much as for some mobile businessmen who don't want to stay and spend as much as they would do in established business hotels, but equally they don't want to be seen to be staying in travel lodges. And sort of budget design is this new category where things on the surface look very nice and quite respectable, but they are budget. And I think if you said budget design to anybody, they would probably instantly first think of IKEA. And so to go back to the first question that you asked, Tyler, I think it's very sort of important that the IKEA name, even though the hotels aren't going to be called IKEA hotels, that they have that association with a brand that has brought sort of budget design into the home.
And in terms of the hotels themselves, what are the really important things that a hotel of this sort needs to get right on the design front?
Simplicity, first and foremost, a comfortable bed, and you know, none of the sort of frills that people think or associate with sort of design, unnecessary, complicated light switches and things like that. The thing that IKEA does so well for homes is really stripping things back to the absolute basic functionality. And if they can sort of put that in a hotel room, then, you know, that's all you need, really, is a comfortable bed and maybe a desk in materials that won't be bruised and battered after the fifth guest has wheeled a suitcase around the room.
And Tyler, just to come back to you finally, have you stayed in a hotel of this sort that has struck you as kind of a model of it, like the sort of hotel that has everything you would want from such a place and not too much of the stuff you wouldn't want?
Oddly enough, the hotel where I think most of our staff stay in Zurich, while not part of a chain, it's a very small two-star. We all stay there. It's called, I might as well give it a name check as people are traveling the summer. It's called the Hotel Rüssli. And it's a bed. It is, you know, one cupboard to store things. It's a very basic bathroom. But as Hugo says, everything works. And even if things get battered and bruised after the fifth guest, this is going to be great news for IKEA anyway, because you know, the company that they're licensing this to and who will be operating them, you know, IKEA will be thrilled because they're still going to have to buy, you know, new products from them. So, you know, even, you know, 3 weeks in, if they have to replace the beds, you know, great news for, you know, the holding company of the IKEA brand.
Well, what's one thing, we were talking then about what these hotels need to get right. Is there one thing in particular you think they definitely need to avoid doing?
I think it's overcomplication, and that's what IKEA has been, you know, very, very good at, aside from the frustration of assembling products, which can occasionally be a headache. But if they can offer something which is streamlined, trick-free, and I think that's the important thing, also something that doesn't date too much. Now, of course, they're always rolling out new fabrics and materials and new treatments, etc. So, you know, in part, they might want to do that. But anyway, most hotels, you know, rooms go through a renovation cycle in some cases, you know, it's even every 12 months. So, you know, they wouldn't be, I think, too much out of step with the rest of the industry. They also have to get the pricing right, and they probably should stick to doing meatballs if they're going to serve any food at all.
That was Tyler Brulé and Hugo McDonald. You're listening to Midori House. 1854 here in London. Skateboarding culture might be usually associated with the sunnier climes of California, but the sport was, it appears, surprisingly popular in Cold War East Germany. A new documentary, This Ain't California, tells us the story of three kids that fell in love with skate in the old GDR. Joining us on the line now from Berlin is the producer of the documentary, Ronald Fietz. Ronald, welcome to Midori House. Just how popular was skateboarding actually in the former East Germany?
Yeah, actually, you know, the group, like the real group, were like 200 people, not more. So it's basically a pretty small group for a whole country.
And you were one of those, weren't you? You were a skater yourself.
Yes, I mean, I grew up in East Berlin, and if you come and if you get the chance to have a skateboard, then you will find a place to skate, and you will find others. And yeah, there's the Alexanderplatz with the big TV tower, and that was our place.
And for those of you that were skateboarding, I mean, how much was it seen as sort of as an act of rebellion? Because it is something that you know, is very much associated with the West.
You know, when we were like small kids, nobody really nobody really had an eye on us. But later on, where we like grew up, the people expected more from us. You know, the government expect you to go in sport groups and like to do all these kinds of organized stuff. And it's, you know, skateboarding is you can't really organize skateboarding and so on. They started watching us and trying to get us in official sport groups and get it under control. And that was the point where we had like hustle with the authorities.
And tell us a little bit about the three protagonists in this film, because I mean you've used footage that I understand that they shot themselves sort of in the 80s.
Yes, they shot themselves, and actually we also shot some material, and you can't really figure out what is what because it's so, I mean, it's so close to each other, so well made that you will not tell the difference which material is actually from the 80s and which is from nowadays. So, but basically they shot themselves on a skateboard, and I mean, one of these kids, they had like a father, and he gave him a Super 8 camera, and they kind of had the chance to film all the time.
Now they were skateboarding during rather turbulent times. They were teenagers in the 1980s. They were all around the age of 20 when the wall came down in 1989. How did their life, obviously everyone's lives changed in 1989, but I mean, in terms of their skateboarding, how did things change for them after the wall came down?
Basically everything changed that time. So when you like grew up and your whole country is falling apart, so then friendships also fall apart. And there was a time where like everybody was doing something else. Some people continued skating, but somewhere else, like in the West or kept in the East, and we got mixed. And so on, this kind of small group, they got split up back the days. And yeah, I mean, life changed a lot that days.
Okay. Ronald Feetz in Berlin, thank you very much indeed. The documentary is called This Ain't California. It had a lot of critical acclaim at this year's Berlinale Film Festival. Do check it out. That is everything we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. The producer was Hannah Jenkins. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager, Ben Jay. After the news is this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs, where we'll learn how one company is using SMS to fuel entrepreneurship in the developing world.
The thing about having your own company is that everything you do comes back to you, the good and the bad things. And the good feedbacks, I think it's the best motivation for anybody.
That's The Entrepreneurs. Up next, Hugo MacDonald, back from his travels in Sweden, will be hosting Midori, same time tomorrow. But from me, Steve Bloomfield, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.